Hello, everybody. For the past 4 years, I've made a practice for my first sermon of the year of highlighting a Christian or Christians who, because of their strong faith, have changed the world for the better. Since the point of these sermons has been a positive one and the purpose to inspire, I haven't spent much or any time discussing my subject's faults. But because these are people we're talking about, they do have them. We are all sinners, I'm afraid, even lauded heroes. George Washington Carver, the subject of my first sermon in this series, was so selfless, self-sacrificing, kind, and generous that he came the closest to being a saint of about anyone I know of. Yet even he had his weaknesses, as those who knew him could attest. So did the subjects of my other three sermons, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Alexander Campbell, and Jimmy and Rosalind Carter. But it is Jimmy Carter I'm going to pick on today, because it is he that I've continued to read and think about since my last sermon. Jimmy Carter was, as many of you know, our 39th President of the United States. Yet rather than his presidency, my sermon focused on the work that he and his wife Rosalind did through the Carter Center, a charitable organization that they founded after Jimmy lost his bid for a second presidential term to Ronald Reagan. Their accomplishments have been amazing, eliminating several diseases in Africa and other places, staving off wars, establishing and monitoring democratic voting rights all over the world, even building houses with their own hands with Habitat for Humanity, and all because of a deep commitment to give their most and do their best for Christ. They are so inspiring, as are the other people I've talked about. And still, there is sin. John was speaking to Christians when he wrote in his first epistle, chapter 1, verse 8, "If we claim that we're free of sin, we're only fooling ourselves. A claim like that is arrant nonsense." What a downer. So we really need to talk about sin from time to time if we're going to guard against it. And guard against it, we must. Sin is a destroyer. It devastates everything in its path, and everything is in its path if we don't block it. It weaves its way into the very fabric of our lives, always looking for new avenues to infiltrate, and never taking a break. So we need to be wise in the ways of the serpent, and not shy away from discussing sin. I should also point out that even though I'm using some of Jimmy Carter's actions as an example of a way sin can set a trap for us, I would never presume to judge him. He is a wonderfully sincere, devout man who has devoted his life to the cause of Christ. I feel guilty and unworthy to suggest Jimmy Carter had faults, but books have been written about him by people who have no qualms about pointing out his shortcomings and being much harsher on him than I intend to be, so I'll timidly venture forth. Perhaps the most common complaint leveled at Carter when he was president was that he was arrogant. We have no way of knowing for sure whether he really felt superior and looked down on others, but his appearance and actions often suggested it. He may have been one of those unfortunate people who spent their childhood being told to wipe that look off your face, when they had no idea what look they had on their face. I've sometimes been told I look sad or mad, when basically I had some mindless TV commercial ditty running through my head, and no deeper thought than what I was going to fix for supper. But it is certainly true that Jimmy Carter is an extremely self-confident man. You don't go from small-town peanut warehouse owner to President of the United States in 7 years without being pretty sure of your own self-worth. And therein lies the rub. We Americans hold having self-confidence in the highest regard. We come close to worshiping it, even. Our picture of the perfect American is someone with their chest out, head held high, a can-do look in their eye, striding forth to conquer the world. That was certainly Jimmy Carter. Yet what if we have too much self-confidence? Can't it easily morph into prideful arrogance? And pride is a sin. In fact, it is the father of sins. We are told it goes before a fall, something that did happen to Carter when he lost his bid for re-election to Ronald Reagan in 1980. Jimmy Carter was a smart man who was used to being the cleverest person in the room. He certainly didn't lack for self-esteem, a very close first cousin of self-confidence. Again, we Americans speak of self-esteem in almost reverential terms. We worked to build up our own self-esteem, and we drill into our children the importance of believing in themselves. But at what point do we start valuing ourselves too much? Can we, in our enthusiasm for esteeming ourselves, forget to esteem others? What happens if we do? The answer is that we hurt other people, or at least annoy them. We're treating them as inferiors instead of equals. Spiritually speaking, we are back to the sin of pride. Practically speaking, we know what pride goes before, and that is what happened to Jimmy Carter. He was notorious for not listening to advice when he most definitely should have. We can't know for sure, but perhaps he wouldn't have lost that election if he'd ratcheted back some of his self-confidence and self-esteem to take more seriously the advice of others. In the book of Proverbs, the key mark of the fool is not lack of knowledge or of self-confidence, but refusal to take good advice. I've thought about this phenomenon before, this problem of taking a good thing too far, of losing our moral balance. It seems as if it should be impossible to be too kind or to love too much. Yet, what happens when a parent is too tender-hearted to let their child suffer a few disappointments or endure unpleasant tasks? We all know about butterflies who haven't had to work to free themselves from their cocoons. They die because they haven't developed the muscles they need to fly. Children are like those butterflies in their cocoons. They have to be allowed to struggle enough to build the mental and physical muscles that they need to live in the adult world. We maybe can't love too much, but we can let that love get out of control. What if we love our children so much we have no room in our lives for our mate? Or reversely, we love our mate so much we have no time for our children. I've seen both happen. Here's another example. Think about loyalty, another virtue we value. It's a commendable thing until it isn't. Should we be loyal to a boss who is cheating the IRS? But what about standing by an organization that has adopted racist practices over the years? Do we turn a blind eye when a much-loved friend pulls off a shady business deal? One more virtue as an example. We are urged to be generous, to give beyond our comfort zone. Yet what if we gave away everything that we had and became unable to support ourselves? How virtuous is it to voluntarily become a burden to others? Or the opposite virtue can be a problem. If in our intent to be thrifty, we squeeze our pennies so tightly that we can't bear to unclench our fists enough to help someone truly in need. The glow of gold can blind us just enough that we can't see the soup kitchen line forming outside our own kitchen door. The problem of abusing a virtue is hardly a new one. In my text for this sermon, Paul is addressing the Galatians in chapter 5, verses 13 through 15, when he writes, "It is absolutely clear that God has called you to a free life. Just make sure that you don't use this freedom as an excuse to do whatever you want to do and destroy your freedom. Rather, use your freedom to serve one another in love. That's how freedom grows. For everything we know about God's word is summed up in a single sentence: love others as you love yourself. That's an act of true freedom. If you bite and ravage each other, watch out. In no time at all, you will be annihilating each other. And where will your precious freedom be then?" Paul's warning them against the temptation to go crazy in the knowledge that they're no longer under the restrictions of the Old Testament law. He points out that too much freedom can lead to anarchy, an admonition we perhaps should take to heart in our own secular context. We Americans light up red, white, and blue whenever anyone mentions freedom, and we should. Liberty from tyranny is a wonderful thing. Yet if we use that freedom as an excuse to do whatever we want, we, like the Galatians, risk losing it. Think what would happen if we drove on the wrong side of the road just because we wanted to. What if everyone did? Or what if we yelled fire in a crowded theater? After all, we have freedom of speech, don't we? We might even call the police if our neighbors are having a loud, drunken party that's still going strong at 3 a.m., Sandy. But don't they have the right to assemble? We know that the answer to these questions is that our civic rights do not extend any farther than our fellow citizens' nose. To ensure the safety and well-being of everyone, we have to set limits. We would have chaos if everyone could drive wherever on the road they wanted, or not stop for stop signs, or speed through school zones. People would die. We Americans assert that we all have certain rights, liberty, justice, and well-being high on the list. Yet, how just would it be if your liberty to do what you wanted meant partying all night and depriving me of sleep? How free would I be if my neighbor's dogs were allowed to roam and tried to bite me every time I stepped out of the house? We can see that our rights can't be carried to such an extreme that they start causing pain and grief for others. Justice demands that everyone be granted equal protection under the law and equal availability to the pursuit of happiness. Paul warns in Galatians that we will devour each other if we insist on our own rights over our neighbor's rights. We can certainly see that this is true in the secular world. Our right to freedom must never exceed our neighbor's right to health and well-being. But how much more is that true in our faith world? If we have allowed ourselves to use our Christian virtues for worldly ends, have we not perverted something holy? The Galatians were taking their newfound freedom from the law to excess, and in the process were hurting others. They were ignoring the golden rule, with unchrist-like results. Paul is trying to turn their heads around so that they are focused on the true gospel message of sacrifice and love. It seems to me that that same message applies to us when we are in danger of letting our virtuous behavior stray too far from our good intentions. Our love for our child is so unbounded, we have none left for anyone else. Our tender-heartedness can't bear to see that child to suffer, so we don't allow her to spread her wings and encounter a few bumps in the takeoff. Or perhaps exercising the opposite virtue leads to our failure. By practicing tough love, we risk running roughshod over tender sensibilities. We leave people wounded and hungry. I've heard of parents, usually fathers, who teach their young children to swim by tossing them in the deep end and watching them sink and sputter and flounder about until supposedly their natural instincts kick in and they swim about like little fish. I was awfully glad my parents didn't try that with me. Considering my poor motor skills and amazing lack of coordination, I would have undoubtedly drowned. If you're going to take the sink or swim approach with someone, you need to be terribly vigilant that they don't drown. And other examples, our need for self-confidence and self-esteem boomerangs into pride and arrogance instead. Our quest for knowledge twists into a contest for good grades and one-upmanship. Or our demand for justice, breeds a passion for revenge. Our focus on our health and wellness slips into hypochondria and self-absorption. Love for our country triggers jingoism and tribalism. We see friendships develop into clannishness and exclusivity. I could go on and on, but you get the picture. The very best things about us, our very virtues, can turn ugly if we let our emotions go unchecked. It doesn't seem quite fair, but we're all old enough to have learned that life very often isn't. So we have to be on guard. We have to examine our motives from time to time. We have to think about others. And isn't that the key? When we abuse our rights and freedoms, we hurt other people. When we lose our emotional equilibrium, it's other people who suffer. In our enthusiasm for a good thing, we have been blinded to what is going on around us. We've lost sight of the golden rule. Or perhaps we are thinking about the people around us, but we aren't thinking about what is really in their best interest. We've lost our focus. So how do we identify whether we have a problem of this kind? And what do we do to correct it? First, we need to prayerfully do some self-examination. It's not easy to admit we might be doing something wrong, especially when we're feeling so virtuous about ourselves. But as I said at the beginning, we have to take sin seriously, which means we need to be vigilant about our motives and actions. Are we a little too proud of our accomplishments and reluctant to take advice? Are we allowing a friendship to exclude other people from our lives? Is our love for our country blinding us to injustices around the world? When we question what we perceive as our virtuous qualities, we should examine whether the results of our actions are godly or worldly. We should honestly judge whether we are helping people or hurting people. Are we making the world a better place, or are we pursuing our own satisfaction? In a nutshell, are we being Christ-like? Think about it. Jesus was the very soul of kindness and love, yet he didn't smother us with affection or sentimentality. His love liberates us to be the best us we can be. With Jesus in us, we don't have to worry about self-confidence or give self-esteem a second thought. We are the children of the King. It's both our honor and responsibility to share that great good fortune with the world, and it's in that context that we should judge our own actions. It's a hard, hard thing to do. We're living in a world that's relentlessly tugging us in the wrong direction. It's easy to feel good about ourselves because we love our kids, our mate, our friends, our country. We're courageously seeking knowledge and justice. But what are the results of all this virtue? Are we really serving these causes honestly and helping people? Or by taking the easy way out, are we just stroking our own ego and thereby missing the mark? We need to shine a clear light on our actions, our motives, and our effect on everything we touch. Are we really promoting Christ's likeness and doing God's will? We need to be honest enough to seek the truth and humble enough to accept the results. Then we need to be strong enough to change. And it probably won't be easy. Identifying that spot with the just right amount of virtue is often not obvious. It tends to vary from person to person and situation to situation, making us have to work to find the just right balance. Sin disguised as virtue is tricky, giving Satan yet another way to lure us into complacency and self-satisfaction. We must be vigilant, holding up everything we think or say or do to the standard of Christ. The closer we come to achieving that ideal, the closer we will come to becoming truly virtuous. To sum up all this, I am basically suggesting 4 tests for telling whether we are taking a good thing too far. Prayerful humility, which provides an openness to the possibility that I need to make changes. Asking whether I am exercising a right or a virtue in a way that interferes with other good things of at least equal importance. Asking whether I am exercising this right or virtue for worldly rather than godly purposes. Asking whether I am exercising it in ways that make me more rather than less like Jesus.
You've been listening to a message presented at Hayes Christian Church. Hayes Christian Church is a non-denominational fellowship in Hayes, Kansas. We are supported by the generosity of our members, attenders, and friends. The financial support we raise goes to projects which further spread the gospel to those who do not yet know Jesus, to local, national, and international missions, and they help to keep these podcasts free. If you'd like to share a monetary gift with us, please visit our webpage at hayeschristianchurch.org and click on the donate button. Or you may mail your gift to P.O. Box 1111, Hayes, Kansas 67601. If you have questions, comments, or would like more information, we would love to hear from you. Simply go to our webpage and click on the Contact Us form. Thank you for your generosity, and may God bless you as you seek to follow Him.